Get ready to meet the trailblazers driving the human change behind our clean energy future. This week, our trailblazer is Professor Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize winner. We take you beyond a conversation about the cars we drive, the tech we build, the food we eat, and the economy we power. We're talking about breaking through barriers in the way that we think, work, and live. We believe conversations about our clean energy future should be as relevant around a kitchen or a classroom table as they are around boardroom or political tables. We're here to fuel a new energy conversation, and it starts with you. Well, Professor Muhammad Yunus, it is such a pleasure to have you a part of this Trailblazer series. Thank you so much for joining us. I wanted to start really at the very beginning of your story, which is a truly remarkable one. You were born as the third of nine children in a country we now know as Bangladesh. I'm interested to know, as someone who now is one of the world's most renowned social entrepreneurs, has made such an indelible mark on the planet, where did your drive come from? What's the origin of your passion for the work that you do?
Well, I don't know really. I was born in the village and I went to school in a village school, one-room school. And when I was 8 years old, I came to the town with my my parents in the town. So I went to the local school. And that's my schooling began. And the schooling is the only thing that enjoyed and have fun and got involved with many different things like the scouting. I was very taken by scouting and being a cadet in a cadet formation. So all kinds of things that I got involved in. Scouting took me to rallies, national rallies and international jamborees. Went to Canada to attend the 8th national jamboree, 8th world jamboree in Niagara on the Lake. So as I was 15 years old at that time. It was a fantastic experience. And on the way back, our association of Boy Scouts in Pakistan, they bought 3 microbuses. Volkswagen microbuses from the Volkswagen factory in Germany. So we drove these 3 microbuses all the way back to Pakistan, because this money was used, which was supposed to be used for a plane fare. So instead they thought, why don't we just buy the microbus and drive them through, so it will be some asset for the Association of Boy Scouts. So that was a fantastic experience. We were on the road for 5 months, going through all kinds of countries. This is a post war Europe. This is 1956. So you can imagine what kind of experience a 15-year-old would have. So this is the journey. And one after another, this encouraged me to do that kind of things and take challenges, take new ideas and try them out. That's how it began.
Wow. You're now affectionately referred to as a banker to the poor. Where did the origin of the idea for microfinance start?
There was no such idea about microfinance. It all began because of a massive frustration that I felt when I was teaching economics in the university where I was teaching in Bangladesh, because the poverty was everywhere. There's a famine going on. People are dying of hunger. And in the classroom, we are talking about beautiful, elegant theories of economics, how everything can be solved. I said, this has nothing to do with the people. So here people are dying and we are talking about the beautiful theories and how growth can take place and all kinds of things. I said, this is a totally disoriented subject. I don't want to pursue that. So I felt guilty that I had to study this subject, which has no meaning. So I wanted to find a way how to make myself useful to people. I saw teaching this kind of subject is not making me useful. So I went to the village every day to see the people, real people, right outside the campus, because this campus was located right in the middle of the villages. So it's easy for me to be in the village. So that village became part of, as a sort of my university. The real learning began. So my purpose was to see if I can make myself useful, even for a day, for one individual person, even a tiny one, it's okay, but I must find something that I make myself useful to somebody. So that led me to do this thing and that thing. And I became very familiar with people. People became familiar with me. They felt I'm one of their villagers. They forget that I'm a university teacher and so on. And then I saw over months and years that I've been associated with the village, the loan sharking that is going on in the village and the victims of the loan sharking. And I felt very sad that people have to suffer so much for such a small amount of money. And how to make myself useful to them, to protect them from the loan shark. So when that simple idea came, why don't I just lend the money myself? If I lend the money, they don't have to go to the loan shark. The problem is solved for that person. And I started telling them, look, you need money, you don't go to the loan shark, come to me, I'll give you the money. And that's what began. And they loved this idea. They couldn't figure out how I did, why I did it, but they thought it's the greatest idea that they could get, that they can get money without being harassed, without being punished for the loan, and so on and so forth. And this is so easy. And it became bigger and bigger, and I became very enthusiastic about it, that look, it looks fine. And the only message I have, you, whatever money you need, I give you, but return the money whenever you can. There's no restricted time limit or something, anything. So it's very casual, very open. And as it grew bigger and bigger, my money was running out, and I tried to see how to find the money. I went to the bank to see if they will lend the money to do that. They said, no, bank doesn't lend money to the poor people. So the battle began between me and the banking system. That battle continues even today. And then later on, we created a bank for the village called Grameen Bank or a village bank. And I never had an idea that it will expand all over the country, now all over the world.
I love that it started from a place of challenging yourself to be useful, even in every encounter, every day, in that really simple way. And that's the origin. That's
very remarkable. Simple way. Very simple way. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, you know, you mentioned the bank and the battle. I'm blown away that even with everything you've done, it continues to this day. But how did you go in those early days of people just saying, this is not the way finance is done? You know, we do finance on credit histories. We don't give it to the poor people. How challenging was it to get people to believe in your idea and get momentum behind it?
Well, people thought it's a funny thing that I'm doing. It's something of a kind of a mockery of a system, and I just trying to pull their legs or something like that. They didn't think it's a serious thing. I'm doing. Actually, I'm very serious. I said, they always explain to me, they don't lend money to the poor people because they are not creditworthy. I have heard it so many times. I said, my God, they're explaining that it's the fault of the people. They are not creditworthy. That's why they cannot lend money to them. Then I told them, should you blame them for not being creditworthy, or should they blame you for not being peopleworthy? Why didn't you fix yourself first before you blame anybody else? Because your fundamental mistake is you're not worthy of the people that you want to serve. And they keep selling that it cannot be done because people need to have the, like you said, about the credit history and so on. I said, I'm doing it. I don't ask any credit history. They need money, I give the money. That's all. I know that they never had the money, or if they had the money, they have had it from the loan shark. That's not the story I want to learn about. I want to forget about that story. I want to create a new story. So I said, money is something that opens up their creative power. So I gave the money to do things they wanted to do. So this continued and continued. It's never resolved. Even today, after so many years, 45 years or so, still banks don't touch what we do. They, despite the fact it got the Nobel Peace Prize, the bank got the Nobel Peace Prize. It's celebrated in every single country, including the United States. We have a big program called Grameen America, and there we are in 15 largest cities in the USA. We give loans to over 140,000 women, all women, 100% women, and loans starting from less than $500, and with 100% repayment. So we have lent out over $1 billion now. This year we'll be lending a loan 1 year over $500 million. So it keeps growing and growing, and the repayment is 100%. So this is it.
It's unbelievable. And I want to ask you about that piece you mentioned there. You've given all your loans to women. Another thing I found a really interesting part of the model is this solidarity group feature. Can you explain a little bit about why women for the loans, and why this group and this kind of social collective was a really important part of making microfinance work?
You see, I got into battle, as I said, with the bankers, always as exchanging accusations from each other. They said, this is, you are wrong. I'm saying, you are wrong. I said, look, you took the word credit. Credit means trust. you build the whole organization called a bank on the basis of the credit, the trust. You are a credit organization. But you create the organization based on distrust. You see, entire organization is built on distrust. The moment somebody comes in, you distrust. You bring your lawyers to check him out, whether you have to give any penny to this guy. So you don't trust him as a person. Your lawyers have to certify this is safe and secure and so on and so forth. And you grab all the things he or she possesses before you give the money. So I said, we came back to install the word credit in its true sense. It's based on trust. We have built a system where we have no lawyers. In our entire system, as I was explaining about Grameen America, and we lend them the same amount, about $3 billion a year in Grameen Bank, not a piece of legal papers between the lender and the borrower. So we are the lawyer-free banking. We don't have any lawyer in our system, but people still pay back. So I said, how do you justify all these lawyers and so on and say, okay, and then you lose your money. They don't pay you back. Our repayment record is much better than your repayment records. So I said, why do you do that? So I said, you should be learning how to do the banking rather than telling others how to do the banking. So we started doing things in a way. See, everything you do, the way we learn how to do this, we look at you how you do it. And once we learn how you do it, we do the reverse. You go to the rich, we go to the poor. You go to the city, we go to the village and remote village. And you go to men, we go to women. You bring your lawyers, we said no lawyers, no collateral. We don't need any introduction from anybody, any information from anybody, any history from anybody, not from even from you. We don't want any information from the borrowers either. The fact that you want to do that, this is I'm with you, that's all. So everything is a reverse. So we created a banking system which works for people. So you took it away to serve the rich people. I said, your basic principle is the more you have, the more you get. And if you have little, you don't get anything. So as a result, half the population of the entire world is detached from the banking system, even today. And that's why my complaint comes. After all this demonstration of microcredit in every single situation all around the world, every single country in the world, how come banking system remains completely immune to this? You cannot get the microcredit walking into a big bank, that a very famous international bank, or whatever bank you have in your city. Or so. They will not touch that. They will bring their lawyers, they will bring all the things, and then say you're not qualified, your credit is not satisfactory, or your project is no good, and whatever it is, or you don't have enough collateral to offer. So how come you don't change it? After all this recognition and so on. So this is the continuous process that we get. So one of the things that we did to make it simple for us is a more process of simplification, not the solidarity and those things came later on when you made the group. Because we said banks made a strange rule. Everybody has to come to the bank to do the banking. We reversed that too. We said in our principle, people don't go to the bank go to the people. So that's where we started coming. That's how we did it in the village. We came to the people, house to house people. We are not saying that come to our office. We didn't have an office either. So we went to them. To make it easier for us, we said on such and such day, on Sunday morning, at such and such time, you come together at this spot. We'll be here. So that I don't have to go to every single house separately. So that's the group idea came. And group became bigger and bigger. So we said, no, you have to have a limit. It's getting crowded and so on. So we came out with the idea of five-member group. It's not more than five in each group, but several groups can make out the center. So usually it's a five groups or 10 groups. If it's 10 groups, then you have 50 people. So 50 we can handle, it's easier. So that's how the size of the center is. That became an interesting format by itself, because then people get to know each other. And then it's done. Everything is done publicly. You see, the bank is about secrecy. We make it everything public, open under the tree. We are doing banking under the tree. So everybody knows why you're paying, you're not paying, why you're not, you're explaining why you couldn't pay this month or this week. What was your problem? You explain your problem to your friends around you and so on. You know each other because you meet every week. So these are not strangers to you. So this is how another dimension emerged. Solidarity, friendship, how to protect each other. Somebody explaining something happened in family, they say, how dare he does something like that, complaining about the husband. So they will go to the husband and say, how do you, while you do that kind of thing. Next time you do that, you better watch out. We'll come and take care of you and see how you can do that kind of threatening, because he has beaten up his wife or something like that. So this is how the solidarity and friendship grew out of that. So this is the thing that became the core of our microcredit program.
You mentioned earlier, you know, Grameen Bank has such an extraordinary global footprint now. Microfinance is present in more than 100 countries around the world. It's truly remarkable, the ripple effect that what you started in your own village has created. I wanted to ask you, what's the biggest lesson you've learned about how to scale well? What was the biggest challenge, and what was the biggest lesson from scaling Grameen?
First of all, you mentioned 100 countries. I would say, more generously, I would say every single country. It's the most difficult part is to find a country who didn't have any microcredit, doesn't have a microcredit program. It's such a common thing that people want to do that, and NGOs are trying to do that, government is trying to do that, or somebody else is trying to do that. Maybe small, but it exists in every single country. So it's nothing unknown. It's a common thing and a common experience and so on. It's one thing that it became very popular. Everybody loved it. It expanded very quickly. Within Bangladesh, we covered the whole country right away. And then it spread other countries. They invited us to come and set up our branches. I said, no, we don't set up our branches. You make it. It's so simple. You don't have to bring us there. So you don't have to depend on some foreigners to come and set it. You are good enough to do that. So no, we don't know anything. I said, Dad, you tell us that. Why didn't you come and see us while we do it? So we keep on inviting people to come to Bangladesh. Many people around the world have come to Bangladesh, learned it, started their own program, and that's how it's spread. And then the next complaint is, we don't have the money. Nobody gives us the money to lend money. So where do you find it? We are an NGO. We need money to give money. And then the people who give money, they say, no, we are not in business. We are in charity program. So they don't give us the money to lend money. So lending is a commercial thing. You have to go to the central bank and so on. So it became a complicated situation. So how to make that happen? It took a lot of time to governments to accept that this can be done as an NGO activity. That although it's a very business oriented, because you have to cover the cost, you have to make sure that you don't lose money in the process and so on, you grow, so on. And only thing I keep saying that all you need to do is to allow them to take deposits. The moment you allow them to take deposit, nobody has to worry about money, because it's a bank. The bank's business is to take deposit and lend the same money to other people. And that's how the banking business is. Luckily, we got that permission as a Grameen Bank, because we are a bank. So we never had any problem with money. Everybody said, oh, where do you get all this money? Must be donors flushing you with all this money. I said, no, I don't take any money from the donors. We take money from the borrowers, from the depositors. Depositors keep money into us, and we give the money to the people. And we had lots of money all the time. We never had, Grameen Bank never had any shortage of funds, always had the surplus of funds. I said, that's the trick. Just give them the permission to take deposits. In the USA, as I'm saying, I will give them over $1 billion loans and so on. Still, we cannot take deposits. So we have to find this $1 billion to somebody else. Somebody has to lend it to us, somebody has to donate it to us and so on, which is very humiliating, because we're running the business where money comes back, is 100% repayment, cover everything, the cost you incur into the system, but you are not allowed to take deposits. I said, what's wrong with this system? I said, you have to redesign the entire banking law. Today, the banking law is actually the law to create bank for the rich. So everything is designed to serve the rich in the banking law. So I said, then why don't you create a law to create bank for the poor? You call Grameen Bank as a bank for the poor, and you call me as a banker to the poor. Then you recognize that there's a need for a separate kind of banking. I said, why don't you create that separate law and make it happen? To make it extra sure, these days with the bad experience that we had, some of the microfinance program turned into loan sharking program, want to make money for their owners. Because now that you only money you can get is the people who want to invest money to make money. So people easily moved into that direction and to make money, and as a result, turning themselves into loan sharks. So when I talk about making a law, I said, you make sure the law is designed in such a way, it could be called social business microcredit bank. Social business microcredit bank, meaning that owners will never take any profit out of this bank. So that it doesn't have a chance ever to become a loan sharking bank. So this is the one that we, but nobody does that. So as a result, this is languishing. After all these years of work, all the good things you hear about it, it has become a footnote in the banking system. It's never been part of the mainstream at all. So I said, this deserves to be the mainstream because this is what the banking system should be about, helping people to grow. And this is related to the entrepreneurship of people. The moment you bring the money, people become entrepreneurs. All those millions of women who took the money, they're not looking for jobs. They become entrepreneurs, taking care of their businesses and growing businesses and raising their children in that environment so the children can learn how to run businesses. They become partner with the mother to make it happen. So the whole, it became a whole family business. But this is the essence of it. But nobody listens because banking should be with the big guys and taking billions of dollars. That's what the banking is, not for the bank, for the poor.
I want to ask you a little bit about your personal experience being someone trailblazing a new way of doing things. I've read a lot about, you know, the legal cases that were brought against you, the protesters, the false accusations. There's a personal cost that often comes with pioneering a new way of doing things. How hard have you found leading a different way? And how have you stayed at, or managed to be resilient through all that challenge? What's helped you get through it?
Well, one thing I found out very easily, right from the beginning, when you try to do something different, everybody's after you. And we stepped on so many toes in our work. At the beginning, it looked very simple, innocent, but you find out that you have stepped in a very, very serious toe. Like, for example, women, most sensitive part of the toe that we had touched. Everybody was against us. Men, totally against us. How do you dare to lend money to women? Are you making a mockery of the system, or a religion? A religion restricts women to stay inside the home, not go outside. You are encouraging them to go outside, giving money, going to business, and so on. So I had to go come with arguments, religious arguments, how religion treats women in our own religion. And they were so powerful that people had to turn around and go away with anger rather than talk back, because it's a concrete example that we take from the religion, that how women are treated in our religion. And they couldn't speak differently than that. So anyway, this was a very sensitive one. We were declared someone that we are destroying the religion. So we became a religious target. And we became the target of the leftist groups, revolutionary groups. They thought we are bringing capitalism at the village level, with the poor people's level, so that there's no chance for ever to a socialist revolution in the country. They are all waiting for a socialist revolution in the country in those days. And I became a target for the bit of the those extremists who wanted to bring socialist revolution in the country. So our branches were burned. Our staff were threatened for life. They had to run away from their places because they think we are bringing capitalism in the villages and destroy the future of the revolution and so on and so forth. So the right groups were against us. They thought we were bringing revolution by mobilizing poor people. So everybody started seeing things in their own way. So we got used to it. They always have an explanation. And some said, I'm agent of the United States. They trained me well to become the CIA agent in the country. I went to the USA. They trained me well. Now I'm bringing the capitalism and the grassroots. Whoever thought a professor will be working in a village with poor women and so on, he must have some very big connections behind it. Big things to harvest out of this hole. So everybody has a story to tell. So that never discontinued. It continued. I got into battle with banks. Banks hated me because it makes sense that they keep saying that the banking is not as simple as you are making it out. I said, I'm sure banking is not as difficult as you made it out. So it should be somewhere between. So why don't you come back and see where it is? Instead of just saying you're wrong, it's not simple, you can do it at tiny loans with a $50 loan, $100 loan, but you can't do it. I said, try it out. Let's do it together. Find out. I have not done it. I've never done banking in my own life. I never had any course in economics on banking. So it's absolutely new. So I'm learning. And why don't you learn together? Because it's people's fate is involved in that. Millions of people's fate is involved in that. You just can't walk away saying that you're no good. So you are making it so simple. Saying for a while, you look like a hero, but actually you destroyed the whole system by saying that. I said, no, I'm not destroying the system. You are destroying the system by doing crazy things for the people to make it unbankable, to prove that everybody is unbankable until you come and do it for some rich people.
I am so like fired up hearing you say that, and I couldn't agree more. And I think it's just phenomenal, that resolve that you had, and this continual through line for me that you keep talking about of how do you make it simple and how do you keep coming back to usefulness and to that people-focused purpose that just seems to run through everything you've talked about with Grameen so far. I wanted, if I can, to take you to your recent book. You've just written a book called The World of Three Zeros. One of those three zeros that you say the world has to refocus around is zero net carbon. Can I ask you to talk to us a little bit about why that climate change, addressing that properly and appropriately, is one of the three ambitious goals you say the world has to be focused on out the other side of the pandemic?
To make it simple, I'd say what I feel, that I think human being is becoming the most endangered species on this planet right now because of global warming. The message that you get from global warming, that we don't have much time left, we're almost coming to the last station. That this train that we are riding in our economic glory gradually bringing us to our last station, where we'll be extinct, will not exist. It's not far away. It may be two decades, maybe by 2040, things will be settled. Or if you're lucky, may extend yourself to 2050. And by the time you reach 2 degrees Celsius temperature, it's all, game is over. You may hang around for a while, but it's extremely difficult to live on this planet after it goes over the 2 degrees Celsius. And it's coming. It's not slowing down. But despite the fact we have the Paris Agreement and everything, I said, urgency of this has been missed out completely. We are all talking as if something will happen, they will take care of it. Who am I to talk about it? I said, everybody, every single person on this planet has to realize that our house is burning. And we don't realize that. We think, oh, and that's our children are marching on the street. They call themselves Fridays for Future, blaming their parents that you destroyed our future. We are not listening. Why are children accusing us for stealing their future? They say, you have stolen our future. It's not a single voice. It's all over the world. These children, they see their future as a stake, but their parents don't see anything. They are busy having a party inside that burning house. And that party is about the growth, about the prosperity, about all the things. I said, where is the prosperity? Where is the growth when the house is burned and we are all turned into ash? So I said, that's the essential thing. We have to realize that this is not going to save us for long. It's only a small time of opportunity. And I thank pandemic very well. I said, pandemic has focused this whole thing, revealed all the problems that we had, revealed that the train which was turned, taking us to the ultimate disaster has stopped because of the pandemic. And now I said, this is a great opportunity. Pandemic has given an opportunity to get off the train. We don't want to ride the train which takes us to the suicidal path. This is a suicidal path we are going there. So why don't you get out and find a new path to get away from the disaster that we are heading for? And I said, if you go by the old roads, you'll always end up with the old destination. And our old destination is the death and destruction. So we have to build a new goal, new destination, and build the new roads to go there. Old path will never take you to the new destination. That's a very, very common understanding, that old road cannot take you to a new destination. We have to build new roads to get to the new destination. I said, we have done that. Is it experiments? Microcredit is one. Turn around the whole banking system. Banking system is behind us with global warming. They are the one putting money into all the businesses and so on, and then feel good that I make so much money. Because you're fueling the burning process, and then you're saying, you're bragging that you're making money. So what do we do with the money if the house is burned completely? So these are the things that you have to learn. We have to see how to control that and make sure we turn it. Banking system is behind many of the problems that we have created in the world. This is just one. Another one, creating the poverty, creating the extreme wealth concentration. All the wealth of the world is concentrated in few hands. 99% of the wealth of the world is in the hands of 1% of the population of the entire country. 1% owning 99% of the wealth. Where is the other 1% of the wealth? Who is it? The 99% of the population. We're at the bottom of the heap. So if you draw the income map, you'll see 99% of the people at the bottom of the map. They have no wealth, only 1% of the wealth. But all the wealth is way above on the map, on the sky. There's 1% people holding to 99% of the wealth. I said, what kind of economy is that? When the wealth separates out from people. People is in one end, wealth is in the other end. And that gap is widening. Wealth is moving away from that. Every second, it's moving away. I said, the real economic system should be bringing wealth and people together. That's the real economic system. You created the economic system the reverse way. We extract, take away all the wealth from the people and push it in the sky. I said, you have to redesign. The pandemic has given a chance to redesign the whole thing. So no question of going back to the old economy that used to be pre-pandemic time. So this is a no-go decision we have to make. We don't go back to the old system. We create a new path to go to the new world. And this is the chance that we have right now. So this is the most important thing. I'm very happy that you raised this question about the global warming. Because this everybody talks about it. Everybody talks about it from a distance, as if I'm not part of it. I am creating the global warming. As a consumer, I'm creating the global warming. Because I'm encouraging those businesses to continue with their business because I'm buying their products. If I don't buy their products, they will be out of business. So ultimately, it's me who's doing that. So why don't we become aware and make sure we stop that?
Yeah, completely. And I think that's one of the things you write so powerfully about in the book is just, you know, when you talk about that economic inequality, just how disproportionately climate change is affecting the world's poor. And yet they're so absent from the conversation tables where we're shaping and framing and discussing these things. And we've got, you know, that 1% sitting there holding a lot of power and that importance you raise around making different decisions, each and every one of us, with where we spend our dollars, with how it is we lead our lives and make our own, you know, decisions, whether it's career choice, whether it's the causes we support. I think that's so powerful. When we think about that economic restructuring, what do you encourage leaders listening to this conversation to be more mindful of as they think about the role that they play in climate change? What questions could they be asking? What pillars should they be thinking about the redesign of their business or their community with? What encouragement would you give or advice there?
First, to recognize that this is a problem, not a problem that you can solve it in your ministry. It needs everybody's participation. Only then a problem of that global nature can be stopped and reversed. It's not a stopping, it's a reversing. Because you have already gone a long distance. You have to come back to safer zone. We are not in the safe zone anymore. So how to bring us back to the safe zone and the safest zone, ultimately. So this is what, and their policies are making it happen. So they have to investigate how, where they're contributing to this fire. And I give I explain it to them by saying that, look, if you want to create a new path, a new road to go to the new destination, there you have to have a checkpoint before you get to the new road, enter the new road. Checkpoint, are you carrying anything with you in your business or in your thinking which contributes to global warming? Are you associated, are you in ownership or even as a consumer which contributes to the global warming? If you are, you have to stop here. Because you have to disengage yourself from all that, then you can get to the new road. Otherwise, you're not allowed because you'll pollute the next world also because you're carrying your habit with you. You want to have the fossil fuel with you. In the new world, there is no fossil fuel. It's all renewable energy. So we have to make sure you go to the renewable. So we have now a chance to build those checkpoints and make sure. And most important thing, I said, the policymakers to make immediate decisions, not only about the government decision, also encourage the public. They are the political leaders. They are the opinion leaders. Shun those things that which are contributing to the global warming. So how to make the renewable energy everyday thing, even if it is not as fancy as fossil fuel energy is all about, it's cheaper and so on. This is a little bit expensive, but it still it saves our life and our children. And always ask every family, do they think about the future of their children? What kind of world they would like to have for their children? Are they contributing to that world to happen? Or they are destroying that life? And if you are destroying your life, the life of your children, future, what about your grandchildren? Will they ever come to this planet? Do they have any chance on this planet? Or they're finished? We are just finishing. It's our decision. We are making those decisions today, which will impact on the children and the grandchildren. And I don't know great grandchildren, because that far we cannot go either. So this is what the decision-making process is. So we have to make them aware. Change the education system. As a political leader, you have to change the education system, because education is one which is creating all this problem. All the things we are putting inside the head of the money, money, money. That's what we're teaching in the school. That you go out and get a good degree from the best school so that you get a good job in the best company. And what do the best companies do? Destroy the planet. But we don't consider that, because getting a job is the destiny for you. That's what the school is teaching us. I said, for the first thing to remember, tell the students in our academic system, the job is not natural to human being. A natural human being is an entrepreneur. And that's how we are born on this planet. We are not looking for job when we are in caves. We were go-getters. We get the problem solved. We fought with the planet and make sure that we survive on this planet and continue to find our space on this planet and so on. This is how we survive. We are not looking for jobs, sending job applications from cave number one to cave number five or something like that. We have grown up as an entrepreneur. But the schools come and say, no, you have to find a job. And then everybody is looking for a job. Then if you don't get a job, you're unemployed and you're guilty, as if it's my fault that I didn't get the job. And I feel guilty because I don't get that job. I'm not good enough. You are good enough, but they pushed you in the wrong direction. You are an entrepreneur. So why don't you create this the education system towards entrepreneurship, so that every child knows he will or she will grow into an entrepreneur. And then you create a financial system. If you are an entrepreneur, where is the money? Money is the oxygen for entrepreneurship. Your banking system doesn't admit that. Your banking system busy with people who are already making a lot of money, not the people who are entering the business first time in their life, in their family's life. They have no concern for that. I said, create those businesses, banking system. We create social business venture capital fund in Bangladesh, asking the unemployed young people to come up with business ideas. And we become investors in them. We become partners with them. And tell them that you make it successful. Once you're successful, you buy back all the shares I own in your business. So you return the money that I give you, exactly the same amount. We don't give you a penny more. It's your business. And I'm happy that you are flying.
I love that focus that you have around asking powerful generational questions, and that importance of embracing our innate entrepreneurialism as part of the way that we're going to drive a real, new, more sustainable energy future. And it also strikes me that a common crusade of yours through microfinance and with this work that you're doing now around trying to raise the importance of this climate conversation is challenging accepted narratives that are untrue. You know, when I think about what you did in banking, it was going and saying you can lend to the poor. You absolutely can. Look, we've got repayment rates that are higher than those that would traditionally have a credit score and go to a traditional financial institution. And here I feel you're challenging the narrative that it's a choice between economic growth or a sustainable energy future. And it's the idea that no, absolutely, we have to see those two things. We can be prosperous and at the same time, we can care for the planet. In fact, those two things have to go hand in hand. Do you think part of the problem is often how we talk about these topics in and of itself?
Absolutely. It's a wrong narrative, the whole thing. I give you an example. I said, economics define human being as someone who is driven by self-interest. You see, the first sentence is a wrong sentence. And that's where the economics grew, self-interest. So we created a business. Economics created a business based on self-interest, meaning maximization of profit. It's driven by self-interest. So you have only one kind of business. I said, the real human being is not only driven by self-interest, it's also driven by collective interest. That collective interest part is completely denied in economics. I said, what I'm doing, I'm creating a new business on the basis of collective interest. That business we call social business. That business is to solve collective problems. Problem of environment, problem of water, problem of healthcare, you name it. There are so many common problems around the world. So we create that as a business, but a business different than profit maximizing business. It's a business not to make money, but to solve problems. It's based on collective interest, not a self-interest. One way is self-interest, another way is collective interest. I said economics gave us a single focus lens. We can only see that far. That's a focus that we have. I said, I'm giving you now bifocal glasses. You can see yourself and also see the world. So when you see yourself, you take care of it, make your business to make money. But at the same time, you have a greater opportunity to change the world and use that as creating a social business. Be your essence is creativity. That's what you are. So you bring your creativity, solve the problem you have. It's a business way, sustainable way, and you are not denying anything to anybody. It's a choice. You make a choice. So these things should be discussed in the classroom. Education has denied all this discussion. Sometimes I say that it's like our education system gives us only the one side of the moon, that we see the one side of the moon, we don't see the other side of the moon. So we don't want to talk about the other side of the moon. We only see this side. I said, now in education system, we see all the sides of the moon. That side has to be discovered. What is the missing a part of that? What do they have there? Is it interesting for me? That has to be brought in. Is collective interest interesting for me? If I feel like I want to solve the problem, and that's what the young people want to do. Young people are not so much self-interest oriented, they are collective interest oriented. They want to contribute to this planet, but you're taking it away, asking them to work for somebody else. I said, you have the creativity of the entire world with you. You're packed with unlimited creative power. That's a human being, as a human child you are. But education system takes it away from you because they encourage you to take a job. The moment you take a job, you surrender all your creativity. Job means you are driven by orders, by instructions. You don't exist as a human being anymore. You are a robot. You are a slave. So why do you want to live a life of a slave? Why don't you be a real human being, do the things you want to do? Nobody's taking away your option. You do whatever you want. These are the options. You do the thing you want to do. Because we turned ourselves into money-making robots, we created the global warming. We created this banking system. We created the extreme wealth concentration. And soon we'll be coming out with the artificial intelligence to take away job from everybody. And the human being will become a garbage on this planet.
I love your passion for the role of business in the future of this purposeful business space, and coming back to that, and also your encouragement that we need to discover the other side of the moon. That's just such a beautiful way of framing, I think, that challenge of where to next, how do we do it differently? I'm conscious of your time, Professor Yunus, and I have a final question for you, if you'd indulge me.
Go ahead.
You've spoken very passionately about your commitment to the next generation, the generations to come. I'd love to ask you, what's your message to the emerging generation of leaders? How do you encourage them to lead? What do you call them to focus on in order to have an impact in creating a better world for those generations to come?
I will not say the leaders of the next generation. I'd say all the members of the next generation. Every one of them is a leader, so we don't have to wait for some special person. Everyone is. First thing I try to convince them, that you are the most powerful generation in the entire human history. I repeat, you are the most powerful generation in the entire human history. Why? Are you smarter than any other generation? No, you're not smarter than any other generation, just like any other generation. But you have one advantage. You're born with unlimited technology in your hand, which even your previous generation didn't have. For that, your previous generation, your parents' generation, will be wondering what you're doing. You don't understand what you're doing because you're so far ahead in technology and it's growing every day. And that makes you a very special kind of young generation. First, feel that you have that power, unlimited power of technology in your command. You can do anything you want as a person, not as a group, not as a generation, not as a leader, as a common young person. You have that power inside of you. First, you feel that power. You convince yourself or persuade yourself that you have the power. Once you feel that, yes, you have, it makes sense to you that you have that power. If you have it, if you feel it, ask yourself, what use am I going to make of this power? And that's a very important question. Because if you don't ask that question, you'll be wasting your power. It will be just wasted because you never used it. You never asked that question. So I said, most important thing to ask yourself, what use you want to make it. And remember, you can do anything you want. Anything that you want can be done. It's a question of imagining. You imagine it and you have be bold in your imagination. Nothing is impossible for a human being. It's more true for your generation than any other generation previous to you. Nothing is impossible for a human being. Whatever wrong things you see, you can fix it yourself. People say, hey, who are you to fix it? Everything starts with a very small step. And I gave my personal example. I said, I started this microcredit program, entire thing with $27. and never had an idea that it will grow beyond my village that I was working with. But suddenly it starts happening. And still at each stage, I thought this is the end of it. It was not the end of it. It continued, continued. And I didn't do it. People did it because the time was right and people wanted it and it happened. And they were trying to stop it at every stage. At every stage, they're very convincing argument why it should not be done. Why it should not be done in the way we do it. Why this is not banking. This is some superficial thing. All kinds of convincing argument, but it didn't stop. It continued. So I said, every long journey stops, starts with a small step. And when you do it, you will be starting with a small step. But always remember, when you imagine the biggest thing possible in your capacity, but start very small. And then gradually, step by step, you'll come in closer and closer. Someday you'll be surprised you got there. And this is your chance. So be aware of your power and make sure you use that power. And figure it out what you're going to use it for. Anything you want can be done.
Oh, Professor Yunus, what an inspiring note to end on. I love that. You know, imagine the biggest impact you could possibly have with your capacity and then start small. It has been so inspiring to talk to you. I've taken so much from our conversation around simplifying ideas, bringing the trust back and putting people first, making sure you take that first step. Challenging the narratives and the conversations, being prepared to ask those tough questions. And I just really want to encourage everyone listening to join us on that journey to discovering the other side of the moon. Thank you so much for your time, for your insights, and for your inspiring leadership as a trailblazer. I'm so grateful for the contribution you've made in the world and are continuing to make. And it's been an absolute pleasure to be in conversation with you.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thanks to EY for partnering with us to amplify people following the path of most resistance. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and subscribe to the series. Are you a trailblazer or inspired by a trailblazer? Leave a comment, let us know, join the movement.